This is the fourth in an Elder Hostel series on Christianity and community, and today we'll be talking about the Shakers, or the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Coming. Okay, that's their official name, the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Coming. I had thought that maybe I should start out by saying something about what we've done so far, but maybe we'll save that to the end and review a little bit then. But the Shakers, if you look them up in the dictionary or an encyclopedia of religion or something like that, you might get something like this: a celibate millenarian sect with socialist communities. Now, let me tell you what that is. Celibate, I think, explains. You know what that means, right?
No creation.
Millenarian sect, which is not the opposite of celibate, with socialist communities. Okay, let's start with sect, maybe. This is a term that's used by sociologists of religion, most often in contrast to church. So they look at religious groups, particularly Christian groups, and categorize them as either churchly or sectarian. The Amish would probably qualify as sectarian. What that means is they have very strong boundaries, right? They separate themselves off from the main body, right? And they regard themselves as some way special. Now, we tend to use the term often these days in a way that's not neutral. We tend to use it in a pejorative sense, so that you'll talk about the sectarians at Waco. The sectarians at Waco were also millenarian. I'll say something more about that. But the idea is the strong boundaries of membership, very clear definition of belief, which is distinctive from other groups. And very frequently, one of the things that means is that the membership is not a mixed membership. The Augsburg Confession was one of the primary definitional documents of Lutheranism. In the article on the church, says that the church is a mixed body containing both true and false believers. Right? Now, what does that mean? It recognizes that God's work is not always visible. Right, that people can objectively meet certain criteria, and maybe on the inside they haven't, right? Or that we don't say you can't come and hear without deciding that you're going to join us. It also, for Lutherans, it also goes with our understanding of simul justus et peccator, that we are simultaneously saved and sinners, so that we're always mixed. We're never completely pure, that we don't have perfection as our way of life. But sectarian groups tend to want to have a pure membership. Only the true believers. Only, reminds me back to the volleyball team. Here's a good example. On Wednesday nights in Northfield at the middle school, Northfield Rec has open volleyball. Anyone is allowed to play. They rotate in and out on two courts. On Wednesday nights, the teams play, right? And the teams are the really good, devoted players, right? So that's the sectarian volleyball night. This sect is millenarian. What does that mean? It's related to the millennium, right? The thousand-year reign of Christ, which is prophesied in the New Testament writings. There are various kinds of millenarians. I don't think we need to go into the distinction between post and pre and this and that and so forth. But a millenarian group tends to have a worldview which anticipates a new age. Okay, there's a very technical meaning of millenarian, and then there's a more diffuse meaning. And the more diffuse meaning is this expectation of a new age, or as Stephen Stein has said about the Shakers, that they expect a new dispensation of regeneration and perfection, a new era, right, when all things will be made new. Now you see how that goes well with sectarians, right? It also went, that's something that we saw in Waco, that eschatological expectation of the last days, that something is going to happen. When that stuff happened at Waco, it was right when I was teaching the Radical Reformation in class. It was absolutely perfect as a pedagogical device. You know, teachers are always turning the most tragic events into a pedagogical device. Because it wasn't unlike what happened in Munster, where those people tried to set up an Old Testament theocracy to restore the people of God to their earlier purity. Right, and then it was a big decibel, and that's what got Menno Simons to decide that he shouldn't be, as it were, hiding his light under a bushel and staying a Roman Catholic priest when he really didn't believe it anymore. The fact that the Shakers are celibate, I'll say more about this, but it's related to their view of God and their understanding of the relationship of sexuality to sin. And then socialist communities means that they have a particular economic arrangement. They live in communal villages made up of families, constructed families, not natural families, with property in common. Okay, and, you know, and very much, in some ways, very much like Holden Village. You have a common kitchen, separate places to sleep, a place for worship and so forth. This is a very American group of the ones we look at. This is the one that is distinctive to the United States. There are no Shakers anywhere else except in the United States. Although its origins are in England and perhaps a little further back than that in France. And I suppose the other thing to say about the Shakers and their American context is that their aesthetic has certainly come to be understood as a, I might go so far as to say, as a classic American aesthetic. Okay. Now, what I'm going to do here is give you three contexts in which we understand the Shakers, and then something about their origin and development, and then talk about the life. And we'll just kind of watch the clock and see when it seems good to have a break. Three contexts. One you already, we've already talked about. That's the Radical Reformation. The second is American Utopian Experiments. So, and Bob Keller said, I think it was Bob Keller said to me after last night, now you didn't tell them what Luther thought of the Radical Reformers. So, while I'm writing, let me tell you. He thought, he called them the Schwärmerei, which means gnats. That are swarming around your head. Utopian experiments. And then the third is revivalism. Okay. We talked about the radical reform. Remember, there were three kinds: Anabaptists, rationalists, and spiritualists. The Shakers we can trace their origins to this spiritualist wing of the radical reformers. And as I said last night, probably the most well-known group that survives from that stream are the Quakers or the Society of Friends. As their name suggests, the spirit is more important to them as a means of revelation than other things would be, like an office, such as the abbot, or a text, like the rule, right? Or a set of practices like the Amish have. So there's much more an expectation of the outbreak of a charism, a gift. And we probably, the contemporary example we would think of, although it historically doesn't connect here, is the charismatic movement or Neo-Pentecostalism with the outbreaks of the Holy Spirit. The Shakers spoke of this as a gift. And so what you were trying to discern if someone came with an innovation or so forth is this a gift that's given to us to know? As I said, we think they might be related to a group of French spiritualists who moved from France to England. They're called the Shaking Quakers. Right? Those of you who are at Pleasant Hill, you keep me on track here. Okay, so that's one context in which we see the Shakers. Another is American utopian experiments, of which there were many in the 19th century, through various groups of people, not unlike the 1960s again, who were looking for a new way of life, and frequently that entailed to some degree a removal from society and setting up an experiment in a new kind of life. One is the Oneida community, which lasted about 40 years from the 1840s to the 1880s. They were quite different, in some ways similar to the Shakers, but in other ways quite different. They were perfectionists. They thought that it was possible in this life to get past sinfulness, right, to a state of perfection. They practiced complex marriage, which was a sort of a form of eugenics, but also was meant to regulate relationships between the members of the community. Okay, so that there was complex marriage, not in the sense of polygamy, but as a fluid kind of arrangement that changed from time to time, and it was all regulated by the leadership of the Oneida community, John Humphrey Noyes in particular. Now, in our more skeptical moments, we note that of the children born at the Oneida community, a great number of them had John Humphrey Noyes as their father. Okay. Probably what the Oneida community is best known for now is its silverware. They were converted to a joint stock company in the 1880s. Another example comes from the Transcendentalists, the Ralph Waldo Emerson, Margaret Fuller, Louisa May Alcott's father, whose first name that starts with a B and beyond that is escaping me.
Bronson,
yes, thank you. Many of these people were also involved in usually very short-lived experiments. Brook Farm and Fruitland are among them. Frequently, the more liberal or progressive abolitionists would have something to do with this. If any of you know Angelina and Sarah Grimke, they lived for a time in one of these communities, running the school there. So when we think about the Shakers in the 19th century of the United States, we need to realize that although they were doing something quite distinctive, they weren't without their cousins in this project. And third is revivalism. Now, this is also a spiritual phenomenon, an outpouring of the spirit. It has a concern for perfection. But it tends to happen in the United States, particularly among in the First Great Awakening before the Revolution, among Congregationalists and Presbyterians, and in the Second Great Awakening at the turn of the century, especially Methodists and Baptists, but not excluding Presbyterians and Congregationalists, were very influenced by this. And it was a time of awakening. Great mass meetings were held. There were long periods of preaching at which many people were converted. And sometimes there were quite dramatic manifestations of the spirits moving. So you read descriptions of these about people falling on the floor and having the jerks, barking. So there were these physical manifestations of the spirit's possession, although they didn't use the vocabulary of possession. Yeah.
They started in the early 1800s?
Yeah, Cane Ridge, I'm thinking, is 1806 or 1802 or something like that. Again, it's one of those things that you can't say it started, you know, the first one that was famous, and it seems to build into a kind of crescendo and then taper off. Revivalism is a key element in American religiosity. It's very important to understanding American religiosity. And I only want to mention it here for two reasons. One, because it is this outpouring of the spirit and the expectation, especially after the Second Great Awakening, that this would be followed by a reformed life, that this would be a dramatic difference between your pre-conversion life and your post-conversion life. And in this regard, we see some of the groups that come out of the magisterial reform moving toward an Anabaptist understanding of how you become a believer, right? That you need to have this definable experience. Although Congregationalists have Anabaptist connections, so it gets really messed up and confused.
Yeah.
But don't worry about that. I just want to say that there's an outpouring of the Spirit that expects a reformed life. And secondly, that the greatest period of growth for the Shakers coincides with the Second Great Awakening. So that people who were involved in revivalism and camp meetings tended to be a likely converts to Shakerism. Now, not a large percentage did that, but many who became Shakers had that previous experience. That's the reason I bring it up. Okay, so where do the Shakers come from? How do they develop? There's recently, about 2 or 3 years ago, been this massive new study of the Shakers by Steven Stein, who teaches at Indiana in Bloomington. And I've photocopied a few of his illustrations, which I'll pass around. One shows the location of Shaker villages, and then there's a something of a map of Pleasant Hill, one of the Kentucky places, some pictures of buildings, some drawings of Shaker worship, and then my absolute favorite, which I will refer to later, two Shaker sisters with their saxophones. So I'll just pass this around for you to look at. Steven Stein has really done a wonderful job in this book, and he lays out five eras or five phases. I'm not going to follow these closely, okay? But to give you his chronology. Can you read my writing well enough?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. My students sometimes complain about it. Okay, these five. The first era, mostly pre-revolutionary, but not entirely. He is, as you might guess, the period of the founders. The second is, notice that there's a real parallel with the development of Christianity, right? So this would correspond to the apostolic era, when those who knew Jesus still lived. Okay? And then the next...
I don't understand.
No.
The people who knew Jesus...
No. Let me step back. This is the period of the founders of Shakerism, and I'm saying, just as they have a period of foundation, so too Christianity in general has a period of the founders, which we call the apostolic era. Right? Yeah. Does that make sense, Louise?
Not
this one. No, the dates were much earlier.
Sure.
Yeah. But it's a similar phenomenon at a much later time. Okay, then we have a period of development, which includes structures, teachings, and numbers, growth. The third period, he calls it, draws on an analogy to adolescence. Okay, this is what my, about this third term I was teaching, one of my students said, Professor Lagerquist, we figured it out. When you don't know how to spell something, you just abbreviate it, don't you? Okay. This is a time that's characterized, as adolescence suggests, by various kinds of crises. Some of them have to do with numbers. One of them I'll talk about is a debate about diet, and so forth. Okay, and then the next period is a time of accommodation. And then since 1948, this period can be understood either as a time of dying or as a time of a transfer of the light. Okay, then you use this analogy of personal development, you get to a certain point, right? And then you have to say, oh, well, what's next? Is it death, or does death not mean death? Does death mean something else? Because the numbers have dwindled. Okay, let's go back to the beginning. About 200 years. Part of the reason I gave you the context of those utopian communities, like the Oneida community, is to say it lasted 40, right? Because often what people will say about the Shakers is, well, they were celibate, you know, they must not have lasted very long. And you say, well, 200 years is no small thing. No small thing at all. And then one of the things we might talk about at the end is what constitutes success. Is 200 years of existence a successful community?
I sort of think of them in Pennsylvania Dutch. Are they related at all?
Not at all.
No.
Let's see where the Shakers come from. Anne Lee, who died in 1784, was born in Manchester, England, at a day I did not write down. She was married at a relatively young age. She experienced death of several children, either by stillbirth or shortly after birth. She had no children that survived. And some people trace some of the teachings of Shakers about the relationship of sexuality and sin, particularly to Anne Lee's personal experience. I'll say more about that later, but it certainly has an influence. I don't think it's a sufficient cause. She, as a young woman, became related to this Shaking Quakers sect, and the English records show that she was imprisoned several times as a result, remembering that these radicals tended to be outside of the established church. She and a small group immigrate to upstate New York in 1744. And there they did some traveling around and preaching. One of the things that was characteristic of them at that time is that they were pacifists, as are the Amish, and preached non-resistance. The fact that they did that and were British during the Revolution earned them the disdain of many of their neighbors. And Anne Lee was imprisoned and suffered to some degree, large extent because of that. That caused, among other things, that caused them then to stop doing this traveling preaching. So no more gathering. Okay. After her death, new leaders emerge, first two who had traveled with her from England, and then later a woman named Lucy Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, who was an American convert who had been particularly close to Anne Lee. Also, increasingly, she'll be called Mother Anne. Under this new leadership, the numbers grow. Probably the largest number was in the 1840s, in about 6,000 members at that time. And at their height, they had 19 villages spread over 8 states. And when you see the map, you'll see where those are located. You'll also notice that there are some Florida communities that are numbered in the 20s, but those were opened after others were closed, so that the total number in operation never exceeded 19. A reopening, more preaching was part of this. The spirit of the times and revivalism certainly provided a fertile field for that preaching. And the decision was made actually not long after Ann Lee's death in the 1780s to begin to gather people into villages. So instead of living scattered around, they came together. Communal property was not initially part of the vision, but it grew to be part
so
of the vision.
Were women preaching too?
Yes, yes. Both women, and men were preaching. Yeah. One of the things that's been said about the, and this is a point of some, you know, interpretation. The concern about gender balance among the Shakers meant that women had leadership positions to a degree almost unparalleled in other 19th century religious groups. But there are other things about their life that were quite conventional. I said they spread to the west, out to Kentucky and Indiana, and the Donners have been to an elder hostel at Pleasant Hill, Kentucky, which is one of the reconstructed villages. There are others that have been reconstructed, and you can find them in any guidebook to living history museums. We also find in this period the development of the life and teaching, including in the accounts of the finding, their founding, and the view of Ann Lee. So especially Stephen Stein is very good on this. He shows us how the things that are said about Ann Lee develop. And you begin to hear, as I said, here called Mother Lee, Mother Ann, more often. And particular documents are produced, a concise statement, a candid statement, a testimony, a manifesto. And finally, in the 1820s, the millennial laws, okay, that tell what the life is like. All of this is an effort to have, on the one hand, union and order balanced by gift, okay, which is a continual project in any group. How do you keep the spirit and order? How do you make that happen? It's in some ways it's another expression of the question about individual and group, right? Because one way that individuals can assert themselves is say, well, I've received a gift. God has spoken to me. I don't need to do garbology. Or, you know, that's a trivial example. But how does this, the spirit is probably the most underdeveloped doctrine of Christianity. And I think, frankly, it's because it's chaotic. Where the spirit blows where it willeth. And the curtains can catch on fire, right? And so we've been cautious about it, and the groups that have allowed the spirit to blow where it willeth have tended to be pushed to the edges. In the 1840s, there was an outbreak of what was called Mother Ann's Work. It was a period of heightened spiritual activity. This had been going on to some degree, but this is the period from which the Shaker's spirit drawings come. You've perhaps seen reproductions of them. I have one on my wall at home, which is a lovely floral, I think it's maybe pen and ink, in a circle with some words around it and a center point. Often these were messages that members of the community received for other members, particularly for elderly members. There were also gifts of new forms of dancing and gifts received about regulations in the community. And these all then had to be tested by the ministry. I'll say more about what those were. It was also in this period that discussions arose about diet. Very interesting. Now, this is a period of a lot of dietary experimentation in American history. The graham cracker is developed in this time period by a man named Sylvester Graham, I think, right? And the idea was that you should eat more healthy foods. It's also the origin of Kellogg's. That company comes from this era. And the Graham diet sounds dreadful, frankly. The Grahamkes practiced it for a while. And the thing that sticks out in my mind about their culinary habits was on Sunday, they boiled all the food for the week and ate it cold. Sounds pretty unappealing, doesn't it? But they were trying to figure out how to get the digestive system to work in the most regular way, in a way that would be least likely to cause you to be a disruptive personality. And some Shakers thought this would be a good idea if they would adopt the Graham diet. Others were arguing for a strictly vegetarian diet. This was one about which the conflict sort of spread from one village to another. This one didn't work out very well.
Like fat.
Excuse me?
Fat.
Yeah. 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 Except the cracker stayed, you know. Some little part of it stays, but... There were other changes taking place. Now we're moving into this period that Stein calls adolescence. Right. The demographics begin to change. The people in the village are increasingly older. The balance between men and women begins to skew a little bit. Their contacts with the world increase. One of the things they begin to do is take in orphan children who are wards of the state. And so you have this skewed kind of demographics in the community, which is missing the middle. Right? And very few, although some, the primary means of recruitment at this point is from those children who are brought in to be cared for by the community, rather like oblates, but rather than the oblates that were brought to the Benedictines by parents who wanted to give them over, these tended to be children who had this need to be taken care of, and not a lot of them stayed. The current situation is, and I haven't kept up on this, there may be one or two sisters who still live at the Canterbury Village, and more Shakers who live at the Sabbath Day Lake Village, which is in Maine. These two villages, which were all that were left after the 60s, had very different views of what the future of the United Society should be. The Canterbury group tended to think that they should let the gift go. Sort of. And that their artifacts would be important, and that their spirit would be important, but they didn't feel an urgent need to keep the society going. And in the early 1960s, membership was closed, so nobody knew could join. The Sabbath Day Lake Village, on the other hand, was eager to continue as a community. And so when I show you these pictures, you'll see the third one will be a group of Sabbath Day Lake Shakers, so the whole group, and that there are three men in that picture, and two of them are youngish. But they have not been able to join because the covenant was closed.
Right. Where is Sabbath Day Lake?
It's in Maine, near Poland Springs. The title Stein gives to this last section is a quotation from a Shaker sister who said, "I almost expect to be remembered as a chair." Okay, let's take a little break before we come back and talk about the life.
First day chairs.
also play probably one of the other most well-known legacies of the Shakers. The Jill Borland singers.
Did they dance in all of their worship services?
Mm-hmm. At the outset.
American musical repertoire.
We use it all over the place. Many people use it who have
no connection with the Shakers, no knowledge of the Shakers, and yet what they're singing there, 'tis a gift to be simple, 'tis a gift to be free, 'tis a gift to come down where you ought to be, is very characteristic of Shaker worldview. It's a gift. It's the Spirit who gives these things. And that the simplicity is a kind of freedom. And that it's about, something about humility in there too, right? Mm-hmm. We won't, to bow and to bend, we won't be ashamed. So it's a way of life which has some affinities with the Amish. But goes in some decidedly different directions. Probably the most distinctive and unusual of their teachings revolve around Ann Lee. And these are not always emphasized to the same degree. Okay, as Stephen Stein argues that they aren't emphasized at all at the beginning because they don't have them. And that in different periods they're more or less emphasized. But Ann Lee, it's the United Society of the Believers in Christ's Second Coming. This is not an anticipatory belief, but it is a confession that Ann Lee is the female incarnation of Christ, which balances the male incarnation of Christ in Jesus. Okay? And so you can imagine that there also has been, in addition to the interest in their furniture and their preaching, their songs and so forth, that in the last 25 or 30 years there's been an incredible interest in this this teaching as a gender-balanced view of God, if you will. There are at least two kinds of consequences of this view of Anne Lee as the female incarnation of Christ, and consequently of Christ's second coming. One has to do with, these both result in a dualist view of sexuality, and one consequence of that is celibacy. Okay, so that sexuality and spirituality are separated from each other, and the goal is to live a spiritual life which is not sullied by sexuality. Now, that's not unlike the Benedictine worldview, which calls for celibacy, but it's quite different in that it has another pragmatic consequence, which is everything gets balanced. Everything gets balanced. And this has lots of implications, which we'll talk about. Celibacy, of course, has implications for recruitment. The boundaries of membership are quite clear in that everybody had to join, and that they made, once they joined, progress toward perfection, and then would join the church family, so that inside of the community there was also some gradation of where one fit in this community. Again, in my conversation with Bob Keller this morning, he said, Dan, one of the things you didn't say about the Anabaptists, he was very gracious about things. And then I said, yeah, there are a few things I would have said. And one of them is that the Anabaptists really are the first to propose an ideal of religious liberty, that one should be able to choose one's religious beliefs. Now, once you choose, you're in, right? But you choose whether you're in or not. And medieval Roman Catholicism, you didn't really get a choice. You were just in. Everybody was supposed to be the same. And what the Anabaptists call for is religious liberty, that they should be left alone. Okay? Fine. You don't want to be Amish? That's great. But just let us be Amish. We won't bother you. You don't bother us. I already talked about the children as wards. We also see, despite the fact that I said that everybody has to join, some influx and loss. At the Hancock Village, which is another one of the villages in near Pittsfield, Massachusetts, in the Berkshires, another of the villages that has been restored, they'll show you that the road runs through the village, right? And the Shakers maintained the road that ran through their village, unlike our road, which we don't maintain. Their road was a selling point, because a farmer would be coming along under the cart, you know, a wagon or something, and suddenly the road is smooth. And you look around, and it's a prosperous farm, right? And so this was a selling point. People would say, oh, these people have a good life. And there was a phenomenon called the winter Shakers, of people who would come and live there in the winter and then go out. There was also, of course, people who would come who would be attracted by this life and come and live for a couple years or 5 or 10 and decide to leave. So there is this in and out kind of business. And there's a wonderful story about a man who I think was an elder who was attracted to one of the sisters, and they ran away to get married, and they got, you know, they got some preacher of some sort who was going to marry them. They get there, and then they suddenly realize what they've done, and they decide this is a horrible idea, and they go back, and they're taken back.
They call that absconding to the world.
Yes. Okay.
Were there more men than women, or more women than men?
Well, the balance of the sexes is my next topic. The goal was that it would be even. Okay. Now, that picture of the Shaker sisters with their saxophones. At Hancock, they have a picture of the Shaker sisters saxophone sextet. It's really fun to say. The Shaker Sisters saxophone sextet was an accommodation to the imbalance that had developed in the community. Because one of the places you want balance is in worship. You saw the dancing in worship, the marches. Well, for the marches, you need balance. And also for the work, you need balance. And so as we come into this later era, and there are fewer, and that was another reason you were asking about why they closed the covenant. They closed it. The formal point of closing the covenant was when the last brother died. But at that time, there was a male convert living at Sabbath Day Lake. And the argument was made there was no one to teach, there was no brother to teach him. Okay. They also had union meetings. These were, they were like little socials in a way, that sisters and brothers would come together in one of the public rooms and discuss things. Right. But this was also, of course, a place where the possibility of these attractions developing was possible.
But they didn't sit on the same side of the room.
No, they had to sit, yeah. My hands aren't as articulate as your description of that. Yeah, they were separated. They didn't sit boy, girl, they sat. Which was not an uncommon practice in 19th century religion. You see pictures of almost any church in that time period, and you have men and women sitting on opposite sides.
Well, I remember as a child, that's the way it was in our Lutheran church.
Yep.
Women, children, sat on one side.
Yeah. So that wasn't so uncommon.
It was interesting to see the peepholes in their buildings where the elder or elders could spy and see that no hanky-panky
was going on. Nothing was going on. But another architectural way that this shows up is that buildings have, like schools used to, the men's entrance and the women's entrance, like the boys' entrance and the girls' entrance. Again, that wasn't entirely uncommon. You see Baptist churches that had that and so forth. But the profundity of it was much more for the Shakers, who were always striving for balance rather than simply for separation. Okay, you see the difference there? That you want balance, not simply separation. Well, that in some places you just do that because you see men and women as being different. But you're not worried about there being the same number of them. Okay? You don't have a worldview that says the world has to have balance between the female and the male always. And here's one place that shows up. Another place is in their leadership structure. Each village had a ministry which was composed of an elder and an eldress who were in charge of business affairs and, oh, that was the deacons, yes, thank you, the deacon and the deaconess, and then the elder and the eldress who were in charge of spiritual affairs. So in all things there should be this balance.
And in numbers.
And that in numbers would be ideal. Now, that's harder to control. And Lucy Wright was the head of everything. They also, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but it seems relevant here. Each village was organized into families. There's the North family, the East family, the River family, and so forth, where they would have maybe 50 people who lived together, had their own place to eat, and so forth. And then the church family, the central family.
Yeah. When you say family,
it's a constructed family. It's metaphorical.
Assigned, sort of?
Yeah.
10 women are assigned to this house, and 10 men, and they sleep on opposite sides of the house.
Yeah.
Use opposite stairway. And
yep. Yep.
But they're under the same roof.
So it's all symmetrical. That's another way to describe it. It should all be symmetrical. The world should be balanced. When you turn, you come down right, you know? It's balanced. Leadership. But they were not innovative in gender roles. So the women did cooking and cleaning and sewing, and men did field work. And so that wasn't, unlike the Oneida community, where they were very innovative about roles. Labor was largely the labor defined by a large farm, divided by sex, but shared and rotated. So it wasn't necessarily the case that the same people did the same job all the time. Within the women's work, the women could rotate and the men could rotate. There was also production, what we would probably call light industry. And through the years, increasingly, this was for sale. Among the things they produced were foodstuffs, fancy work, hand sewing things, capes and stuff like that, herbs, and actually Sabbath Day Lake has revived the herbal industry. They had many inventions, and here's a place where they're different from the Amish, is that the Shakers had a kind of Yankee mentality. They're always looking for a labor-saving device. They invented the flat broom, the common clothespin, the screw propeller, a rotary harrow, and the circular saw, among other things. Most of these were not patented. They ate common meals. I talked about the debate over diet. Each village, several villages then also were under a bishop. It was not under a bishop, but they were linked together, and the ministry of one also oversaw the others. So this striving for union and balance, union and order, along with the gift. You know, they want uniformity between all the villages while still having outpourings of the Spirit. It's tough. It's tough. And then above the whole society was the lead ministry from the New Lebanon village.
And when they worshiped, did they worship Mother Ann? I mean, was like,
they had,
you know, they had, you know,
hymns that Jesus included her.
They wrote all their own hymns. They used nothing from the world.
I know, but did they use Mother Ann as a kind of...
In some of it.
Talked about
in some.
As an equal to Jesus.
Yeah, I think so. And then they have this very distinctive aesthetic, which is form following function. A thing is made, a thing well made is a prayer. This is behind what they're doing. One of Ann Lee's aphorisms, which was the title of a special that was made, I think by, it was shown maybe on PBS, it was privately made, was called Hands to Work and Hearts to God. Okay, so here's a sort of similarity with the Benedictines, this notion that ordinary labor is a form of worship. And, you know, the old sister thought she would be remembered maybe as a chair. The characteristic of the chair is that it's sturdy, it has clean lines, it's light, and you can lift it up on the pegs, right? We still have the winter pegs out here. Right. They'd be higher, but you could put all those chairs up, and then this made it easy to sweep, and it cleared a room to have worship if you needed that space. Well, another example of architecture is that the worships, they had meeting houses, and they also had worship space in some of the dwelling houses, and the one in Hancock has this ingenious wall. I'm thinking it goes up into the wall in the second floor by some kind of pulley system. In any case, it disappears, and as I'm remembering the building, it couldn't have gone this way. So it's not it wasn't a pocket door. It had this pulley system, and it would go up, and then the sisters could have worship on one side, and the brothers could have worship on the other side. Very clever. And
beautiful spirals.
And windows, the windows in the Hancock kitchen, which is partly underground, the sills are not flat. They're like tilted so to magnify the light that comes in. Right. So one of the books of photography about the Shakers that came, also there was an exhibit of these same photographs, is called An Inner Light, and emphasizes sort of the lightness of the decor and this aesthetic which is a manifestation of the light. Okay. And actually, the cover photo from that is an interior circular staircase, which we have the poster hanging in our stairwell at home. I guess I already talked about the production for sale, the reduced number, and that really since the mid-1900s, what's very interesting is that as the numbers have dwindled, it seems like the world's view of the Shakers has grown. That in the 19th century, the outsider's view of the Shakers was sometimes grudgingly positive. You know, they have good roads. We're willing to buy from them. They're reliable craftspeople, but they're a little strange. They're a lot strange in some ways. But starting in the 20s, accelerating into the 30s, 40s, and 50s, there's been this very sympathetic interest in the Shakers, the world of the Shakers, rather than in the Shaker life, being Shakers. People aren't too interested, I'd say, in the United Society of the Believers in Christ's Second Coming. What they're interested in mostly is the music, the furniture, the buildings, the artifacts, the material culture, which I find very ironic about a group that's so spiritually based. And today I actually managed to get done with time for you to talk. And I thought one thing that would be very interesting to talk about is what constitutes success in community life. And another would be to come back to this notion of humility and ask if humility and simplicity are the same thing. And I went home last night and I thought of this discussion about simplicity, you know. What's this simplicity business? Is simplicity best understood as primitivism? You know, that the more primitive you are, the more simple you are. I see people shaking your heads. Why don't you think that's true? Why isn't that a good way to understand simplicity? Of course, some of us claim to have the first.
but there's historical, you know, the first has stood the test of historical time.
Right.
You know, I get humility mixed up with Uriah Heep. That's my point. You know, be humble, be right, and get on.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, Sue, did you want to say something?
I was just going to say, I think something similar. I see humility as an attitude and simplicity as a lifestyle. They don't seem to me to be comparable words, though. I don't think they would be complementary.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that raises this question for me is the collector status of Shaker artifacts. The cost of which, I mean, if you bought a Shaker artifact in the 1950s, you were a wise investor, right?
How would they feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is the question I'm asking, that here's this aesthetic. You make these objects that we regard as beautiful. The purpose wasn't necessarily to be beautiful. It was, you don't have to dust. I mean, it was, you do good work, that's a prayer, you do something that does its job. It's not sentimental, it's not prideful, it's
certainly not Baroque.
It's not Baroque. Although, did you notice those two pictures of the Hancock office?
Yes.
Right? How it goes from a very conventional Shaker building, and then it's Victorianized. And this is the office. See, this is what's really interesting. This is the office. That's where you have contact with the world. Again and again, we have this dynamic with community. What are the points of contact with the world? Are they all the time? I mean, are there no boundaries? Are there strong boundaries with Gates? One of the people that Benedict says needs to be appointed in the monastery is someone who keeps the gate. And he suggests an old monk would be a good one to have. You know, someone who's mature and stable. You don't put an impetuous young person out there meeting the guests.
Were they called monks?
The Benedictines. They called each other brother and sister, except for some of the eldresses who were called mother, or the elders who were called father. Yeah. But how, when we think about our community, when is it insular? No. I told you that initially I resisted Holden Village for 15 years. I wouldn't come here. Because it seemed to me like it was this sectarian thing. And I didn't want to be a sectarian.
Have you heard of Order of Man's?
Yes, but all I'm getting is, yes, I know of those people, so tell us about them.
I knew somebody who was a sister.
Yeah.
And it's totally disbanded now. But it was... single people initially, mm-hmm. young people did it. I think you had to be a certain age. Certainly didn't like it, right? And they were doing good works. Mm-hmm. And I believe they were Christian. Mm-hmm. But they wanted to do their own thing. I think it came out of the Christian group. And now they absorbed into the Orthodox.
Ah, that's possible. Yeah.
They talked with her mother.
But they wore a type of uniform.
Some garb.
The gals were plain blue dress. No frills. They took regular jobs.
Yeah.
But they lived together in a kind of a commune, and yet they were married.
Mm-hmm.
Call each other.
Very good.
Yeah, and that was the goal, is that between the agriculture and the light industry, that they would be able to support themselves. And at the end, when they were down to three communities, Sabbath Day, Canterbury, and Hancock, and they were selling off pieces of land and so forth and property, they set up a trust. So there is a financial trust which provides then for the care of these few remaining members. No, Hancock is totally sold. And actually, that's very interesting. When they closed Hancock, they had an asking price, like $200,000. But they sold it for about $120,000 to a group who agreed to make it into a museum. And there was good cooperation between the remaining Shakers and that group. So one of the things that's most distinctive about the Hancock Village is they have this round barn, but that's not a typical Shaker thing necessarily, to have a round barn.
How much part did their dancing play? Did they do it every Sunday? Or?
Not necessarily, no.
Is this an occasional phenomenon?
During Mother Ann's work, it happened all the time, like daily, every night. It was sort of frenzied in the 1840s and early 50s. One of the villages I'm remembering now, it was decades between times that they used the meeting house. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they weren't doing that dancing. When the balance of men and women got out of whack, then they couldn't do it anymore.
But one of the pictures shows dancing sisters.
Oh, yeah, and I think that's during Mother Ann's work. That's a gift, a particular gift.
Well,
yeah.
After Mother Ann comes up.
Yes?
I just wanted to ask you to please explain the lifestyle of Nonatus community. I know nothing about complex marriage.
Well, what complex marriage, I haven't brushed up on the details of this, but it's been a while since I've read about it more than to be able to say that. It was sort of like you were assigned partners, sexual partners, so that there was this eugenic goal that you would produce the best children. And that there wasn't marriage in the sense that we have it, that there's a relationship, a social relationship, that's established between the two partners.
Did you change, or once you were assigned somebody, you were...
We changed, and that's why it's complex, uh-huh. Is that it's not one-to-one unchanging.
I was just going to ask what happened with Mother Ann's husband and what you thought the death of her children had to do.
Well, Mother Ann's husband immigrated with them, and then he sort of disappears. Some people think that that her experience with sexuality and with childbirth really created in her an aversion to all things bodily. Okay. Now, having said that, you also want to say that it's not unusual among groups that have a dualist worldview of spirit and material to take a very ascetic view towards sexuality. No, and sometimes in medieval church history, they try and trace this to the Gnostics, through the Bogomils, like this, you know. And one scholar of it says, yeah, maybe that's true. On the other hand, it's not real hard to come up with this idea independently. No, because you notice that your body doesn't do what you want it to do, or, you know, we have these experiences that suggest to us sometimes that there's a division. And if you have that experience a lot, you can see where someone would get that idea. I thought I saw one more hand. Yeah, Grace.
How many Shakers are there?
Now, a handful. And it's hard to know how to count, because those three men who you saw in that photograph have not signed the covenant. So by one technical definition, they are not Shakers. Okay? And that's one of the disputes that what... See, I'm thinking that the last Canterbury sister has died recently.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So there are none left at Canterbury. There are only what's left at Sabbath Day Lake, and it's a handful. The other thing they have at Sabbath Day Lake is a huge library. They've worked very hard to preserve their documentation.
Library.